Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Richard Ravitch. He's held a number of high-profile positions in the public and private sectors, and he's been described as a modern-day Renaissance man and a Mr. Fix-It. Among his most notable experiences are head of the New York State Urban Development Corporation and the Metropolitan Transit Authority, where he dealt with severe public fiscal challenges, chief labor negotiator for the owners of Major League Baseball, candidate for mayor of New York City, and, of course, lieutenant governor of the state of New York. Earlier this year, Syracuse Mayor Stephanie Miner tapped Mr. Ravitch to be the chair of a fiscal advisory board to help Syracuse with its financial crisis. Lieutenant Governor Ravitch, welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, let's start with the basics. Relative to other cities of its size in the country, how does Syracuse's financial situation look?
I would say that Syracuse is not anywhere near being the worst in the worst shape. There are a lot of cities far more serious in trouble. But that Syracuse and every other city is inexorably moving to the point where they're going to have to take very drastic actions absent some intervention at the state or federal level, there's no question about it. And one of the reasons that I am helping is because your mayor is one of the few people in political life who's willing to look beyond this budget year and realize what she's headed for and is devoting a lot of her energy to trying to figure out with others what the right approach is to the future.
Well, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you at some point. I'll ask it now. You've worked with a lot of mayors, obviously. So what's your take on Stephanie Miner?
Well, I was impressed when she called me a year ago and said she was going to be in New York City. Could we have breakfast? That she had read about the reforms I had proposed for the New York State budget process and was intrigued by them. And we had breakfast, and she is clearly incredibly bright, incredibly concerned and properly concerned about the future. And unlike most politicians, just isn't worrying about how to get through this year. She understands that the trend lines are all negative, that the obligations that are intrinsic under our statutory and constitutional systems, as well as part of our tradition, are terrible, that our retirement expenses and our health care expenses are going up at a far faster rate than our revenues can, and therefore it's not sustainable. And she's trying to address that as well as dealing with this year's budget. She dealt with this year's budget by using up a large part of the rainy day fund that's available, making it very clear to the public and to the council that she wasn't so sure that next year the dog would talk. So we have a big task ahead.
Well, you mentioned the long-term trend lines and the mayor paying attention to those. I was curious, again, your sense of Syracuse. Does Syracuse, in thinking of how it's going to deal with those, have particular advantages or disadvantages that it enjoys as it faces as it wrestles with these things?
Well, I think that Syracuse has some advantages that I'm aware of. It's got a great university. That makes a big difference culturally, and the impact of a great university in a town, village, or even a city is not easily measurable, but it's significant. Because fundamentally, the problem with local and state government throughout this country is there's too often a disconnect between the world of ideas and the world of politics. You've got, on the whole, some of the better people in politics from this part of the state than is generally true, and that makes a big difference.
So it sounds like what you're saying with those two things is it's the human capital that we may have is in our court.
And I just had the honor of talking to a business group and urged the business community to take a stronger leadership in the problems and not look at it just from what was in this immediate interest, this year's immediate interest for them, but rather in the longer term, because the entire society has this fundamental same problem. We have made commitments that we can't afford, and we have to readjust a lot of things.
Well, let me ask you a question about cities more generally, but rooted in my own experience here in Syracuse. As someone who's lived here for 20 years, and I've lived both inside the city and outside the city's borders, I can tell you that one of the issues for this city is the way it's regarded by a lot of people who live outside of it. Not all of them, but some of them, as a place to avoid if possible, as a negative place, as a lost cause, you know, et cetera, pick your phrase. How do you best combat that view of the city that's sometimes held among people who don't
well,
live?
Well, I'm sorry, I don't have the familiarity with that point of view about Syracuse. But obviously, I mean, I don't know any city that hasn't gone through it. And there will be a restoration. And I think that part of the restoration has got to be to have access to the capital to bring the infrastructure up to date. You have a sewer system that's antiquated. You have, I'm told, police cars and fire cars that are well beyond their useful life. And all of that creates an impression that makes people feel this isn't where the vitality is. The vitality's in the people, and the system has got to change. There's no question about it. Look, as you well know, upstate New York has suffered enormously because of the fundamental economic and demographic changes that have occurred in the United States. There is still, nonetheless, in the world that we live in, enormous economic advantages to urban living. The concentration of goods and services, the lower transportation cost, as the population ages, a greater kind of collegiality, if you will, or socialization of people whose kids may have moved to other parts of the world. So I think that what you're going to see is the population of this country grows and the average age goes up, you're going to see cities become far more popular.
I want to come back to that point a little bit later. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Richard Ravitch, former lieutenant governor, former head of the Metropolitan Transit Authority, and current chair of the Syracuse Municipal Financial Advisory Board. Well, I was listening to one of your interviews from earlier this year, just after you took on this advisory role for the city of Syracuse, and in referring to the fiscal crisis that the city of New York faced in the 1970s, you talked about people coming together, sharing sacrifices, accepting less, paying more, and ultimately getting through it. And I was curious to know whether you think that something has changed in our current political culture to make those kinds of common sense things harder to achieve.
Unfortunately, I do. And I think that what has happened is we have enjoyed the benefits of our prosperity for so long. And we have enjoyed the benefits of a rate of taxation, particularly in the last 15 years, that was lower than practically possible if we were going to continue to enjoy the benefits we promised ourselves. And I think we all got a bit spoiled. And we got spoiled in part because credit was so readily available in the last 20 years as a result of the financial deregulation, the cheap money, and so a lot of gaps were filled with borrowed money because everybody kind of almost in an unspoken way thought that tomorrow everything would be good again. And the banks came to the politicians and said, we'll solve your budget problem for you. We'll discount your future revenues. And the politicians said, that's great. Then we don't have to tax and we don't have to cut. So they borrowed and they borrowed and they borrowed. And then they started selling assets, treating the proceeds of asset sales as revenues for budget balancing purposes. And one of these days, the music's going to stop. And it's like the game that kids play. Who's going to be left standing? either the recipients for public services, the public employees, or the people who hold the debt?
Well, I just had Michael Rebell, one of the attorneys from the Campaign for Fiscal Equity case, on the program, and he spoke at some length about the various financial needs of poor school districts if they're going to supply real educational opportunity for their citizens. And quality public education is obviously one of the things that keeps people living in a city and prompts them to consider moving there in the first place, but it's expensive. So how should we be thinking about this particular trade-off right now between the need for austerity that you've been talking about, I think quite eloquently, and good public education?
Well, I think that, number one, the most important thing is to understand that there is not, on a grand scale, any alternative but public education. That roughly over 90% of the people in the United States have gotten their education in public schools. And even though the world is changing and there are other societies that are emerging with great economic power and great cultural clout and military power, the United States was a leader in the world in terms of our economy, our military power, our scientific knowledge, our health and medical knowledge. And the people who made America great were people who went to public schools. Now, did public schools change that much? I don't think so, really. The average tenure of teachers has gone down, but that's because women have had opportunities to go into the economy in ways they didn't have 50 years ago, where teaching was really the only option. But also, we made some fundamental decisions in this society, like having kids who had learning disabilities, putting them in the same classrooms. We have vast migration of people, which has always been the source of America's strength, but who don't speak English. We have a massive amount of poverty of kids who come from homes where the tradition to be educated was far less than it was perhaps in earlier generations of immigrants. So when people tend to say, well, we got to privatize the public schools, I don't think that's an answer. So, and I can't imagine any more fundamentally important expenditure than educating the next generation. Now, what does that mean in practicality? I mean, the reason that education expenditures have become a larger and larger percentage of the state budget is precisely to deal with the fact that the poorer school districts don't have the same property tax resources that the richer school districts have. So that litigation aside, it has always been true that we have had to help provide in order to ensure the same teacher-student ratios and equality of educational opportunity. We've had to provide resources out of state tax revenues for that purpose. On the other hand, there are a lot of expenditures that I don't think are as defensible, such as the administration of 650 separate school districts. I don't know why we can't reorganize our educational system into 35 or 40 BOCES, and rather than have duplicative administrative structures in all of them. And third of all, I think that the question of support, and maybe this is part of the first point I made, if some larger part of the private sector is spending their money and their resources and their intellectual energy on trying to create alternatives for public schools, rather than supporting the adequacy of funding for the institutions that will continue to educate 90% of our kids, we're in deep trouble.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Richard Ravitch, the former lieutenant governor and former head of the Metropolitan Transit Authority and an expert on city finance. Well, I wanted to ask you one question about your time as lieutenant governor. You were brought in to be lieutenant governor in large part to help with the state budget process, and you produced some reports with the Rockefeller Institute on reforming that process. Now, we look at it today, and in some ways, I guess, from a bottom line or on time perspective, anyway, the process seems to look a bit better. Do you think the process really has improved that much?
No, I do not. I think that we've had on time budgets. The governor has been enormously effective in getting the legislature to act and to make decisions and not torture these budget decisions and extend them over long periods of time. And I think that has helped restore some confidence that the process can work. But there's still an inexorability to certain arithmetic, which is that there are certain obligations that are increasing at the same time as the tax revenues at a state and local level are more volatile than they've ever been, and the resistance to taxes more intense than ever in my lifetime, at a point in history when, very frankly, we need to have them.
Well, I wanted to ask you a specific follow-up on that. I read a piece recently about a small handful of states that have enjoyed some surpluses in the last year. And the politics in each of those states was that, well, we had to make some difficult cuts, but when we can, we'll go back and restore some of that funding. Now that this surplus has occurred, though, what these small handful of states have done is to cut taxes further. So it sounds like it's an illustration of this problem.
That is exactly the problem. And New York State cut taxes twice. You know, it's hard for people to imagine when I sit in a social situation and hear my colleagues in the business community complain about the tax levels, I get very perplexed because when I went into business, the New York State tax rates were a hell of a lot higher than they are today, and it didn't diminish my greed one iota. And second of all, our greatest prosperity occurred when the state income tax rate was higher. It's substantially lower today than it was in the 80s and the 90s, even though it was lowered twice, once by Governor Cuomo and once by Governor Pataki.
Well, before we get to the three questions at the end, I wanted to ask you this last question that ties back to something you said at the beginning about the long-term future of cities, and you had sketched out the beginnings of a vision where they would become more important for more people and more popular. I did want to ask a question about the future of cities. People often write their epitaph, and then the cities resurge, and sometimes people write the epitaph of traditional suburbs, but those seem to still be with us, and people still seem to be seeking them out. So could you say a bit more about how you see the long-term future of cities
well,
in the United States?
I'm old enough to remember when everybody thought that the construction of the highway system and the FHA mortgage insurance system that enabled all our returning vets from World War II to buy and finance homes with very little equity down payments, the combination of that with the interstate highway system was just going to drain everybody from our cities. And we instituted so many countercyclical proposals, an urban renewal program, special financing for inner city housing. But the truth of the matter is, what really changed over years was that as people wanted access to the if you will, the blandishments of urban life, access to theater, to sports events, to restaurants, to more people and different kinds of people. As you got older, the cost of living in the central city was diminished in relationship to the cost of continuing to live in the suburbs. And highways were crowded, and expenses were greater. And so I think we're in a period, and this is not a new thought, of an enormous revival. And when you look at the U.S. Census Bureau projections of what is going to happen to the American population in the next 50 years, and you see the growth rate, and see that they're saying most of that's going to occur in the major metropolitan centers. Yes, sir, I think that's true. And whereas I believe that the cost of automobile travel, even though cars are more efficient today than they were 20 years ago and therefore consume less gas, which, by the way, is a reason, one of the reasons why state revenues are down, that nonetheless it's a very much more expensive way than getting around than public transportation.
Let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
A crazy, fulfilling retirement.
Second, what's your worst trait?
You'd have to ask my wife, children, and grandchildren that question. But from my perspective, it is I have too many interests, and at 79, I haven't figured out what I want to do when I grow up.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
That after being close to failing shop in school, I ended up building all of the furniture in my home.
That was Richard Ravitch. Lieutenant Governor Ravitch, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.